Seismologist Rob Wesson's new book, Darwin's First Theory, is an immersion into the landscape that absorbed Charles Darwin and led him to conceive his original theory of plate tectonics, which then inspired the theory of evolution. Everybody knows, or thinks they know, Charles Darwin, the father of evolution and the man who altered the way we view our place in the world. But what most people do not know is that Darwin was on board the HMS Beagle as a geologist, on a mission to examine the land, not flora and fauna. Retracing Darwin's footsteps in South America and beyond, geologist Rob Wesson treks the Andes, sails along the Beagle's nautical routes, hunts for fossils in Uruguay and Argentina, and explores sites of long-vanished glaciers in Scotland and Wales. As he follows Darwin's path, literally and intellectually, he experiences the land as Darwin did, engages with his observations, and tackles many of the same questions that Darwin had about our ever-changing Earth. Again, the name of the book is Darwin's First Theory. It is published by Pegasus, and it's a pleasure to welcome Rob Wesson to the roundtable this morning. Rob, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. I'm looking forward to it.
Obviously, when it comes to Darwin, we think that we know so much about him. What brought you to this part of his life, and instead of focusing solely on evolution, looking at his theory of plate tectonics?
Well, Joe, I'm an earth scientist myself by vocation and avocation. And when I learned that, I too thought that of Darwin principally as in a biological context. But when I learned that he had been a geologist, actually, before he'd gotten involved in thinking about evolution, I became fascinated with this, and I read more, and I just was totally taken by the understanding that he had a geologic background. And as I dug into it, I realized how important his geologic background had been to his subsequent ideas about evolution.
So when we talk about this mission and the first theory, how did this start out, and what ultimately was the starting point for him of what he wanted to accomplish?
Well, Darwin was obviously a genius, and he was totally curious about everything. Everything he saw, he seemed to ask himself, why is it like this? And when he finished Cambridge, and his mentor, John Henslow at Cambridge, advised him to study geology, and he looked into it, and he really became fascinated with it. And then he went on a field trip with Adam Sedgwick, another professor at Cambridge, and enjoyed it immensely. And just when he returned from that field trip, actually, was when he got the first invitation to join the Beagle. And actually, he was uniquely qualified for this because Fitzroy, the captain of the Beagle, was actually looking for someone who could look at geology while the crew of the Beagle was making navigational charts of the coast of South America. So when he started on the trip, he had relatively little experience in geology. He'd taken geology courses, or he listened to geology courses when he was at Edinburgh, and then he'd gone on the field trip with Sedgwick, and then he had the book, a newly published book called Principles of Geology by Charles Lyell. And Lyell's book was it was definitely groundbreaking in geology, because Lyell was, instead of thinking that things had happened as catastrophes in the past, which was the dominant view among geologists at that time, Lyell was arguing that in order to understand the Earth, you needed to look around and see what was happening today and in the recent past. And so as Darwin began the voyage of the Beagle, and he looked at this first stop, which was an island that we now call Santiago in the Cape Verde Islands, he looked at the geology and he realized that he could explain this in terms of things that had gone around, were going on around him at San Diego and elsewhere in the world. And so he adopted this idea. And as he continued on the Beagle, everywhere he looked at the geology, he tried to understand what was happening, what had happened in the distant past in the Earth in terms of what was going on today. And this was the idea which he subsequently applied to trying to understand the development of the species that we now call evolution.
This was a five-year trek that you pretty much followed, right? I mean, you went and did this literally and also intellectually as far as looking and going to these places and facing the same questions that Darwin did.
That's right, Joe. I honestly didn't go everywhere that Darwin went. I was principally in South America, in southern South America, and I went to the sites that I felt were most important from in the development of his ideas, particularly about what we now, this area that we now call tectonics, which is the area of earth science that describes how the continents came to be the way they are, how they've now, we understand, they've moved around in terms of plate tectonics, and how mountain ranges are uplifted, and how parts of the seafloor have actually sunk as well. So I went to these places that I thought were most important in developing Darwin's thinking. And what I wanted to do was to, wherever possible, to visit these with scientists that were working today that were following up on different aspects of the same problems that had fascinated Darwin 180 years ago.
Rob Wesson is our guest on the roundtable this morning. His new book is Darwin's First Theory, Exploring Darwin's Quest for a Theory of Earth. The book is published by Pegasus. Those questions, how relevant are they today than they were? I mean, are these questions that will never go away? Or has time and obviously the changes to our planet have made such an impact that they bring up different questions, or are they still essentially the same questions?
That is in itself, of course, a good question. The way science works, of course, is we try and understand what's happening, and we're always working to refine that. So in the process of refining, coming up with new ideas and testing them, and when they work better than the old ideas, you adopt the new ideas and discard the old ideas. So what Darwin was really focused on, these ideas about the uplift of continents and ultimately the substance of ocean basins as well. He didn't understand at that time how important the horizontal movements of the continents were. And of course, in the subsequent, and it took really more than 100 years from the voyage of the Beagle. It wasn't really till the 1960s that we understand that geologists came to a consensus that, yes, the continents had moved around the Earth in a horizontal way, and that the collisions of these continents and the interactions of the continents as they moved around were what led to the mountain ranges that we have and much of the geology that's exposed on the Earth. And this is what we now call plate tectonics, these ideas about the moving around of it's. And it really is not just the continents. In terms of plate tectonics, we understand that it's the surface of the Earth is composed of a relatively small number of these plates that are moving around, and the plates carry with them the continents, but they also include big portions of the ocean floor. So these were ideas that developed subsequent to Darwin's thinking about this process. There were really a number of important obstacles that Darwin faced when he was thinking about this. Things like the idea of the ice ages. Darwin, when he was on the Beagle, the ice ages were not generally accepted, and in fact, in England, the ideas of the ice ages weren't really accepted for, I should say that Agassiz in Switzerland was just coming up with the ideas about the ice ages, and really he was a great promoter and promoted the ideas of some other people. But anyway, they didn't really become widely known until the time that Darwin was on the Beagle and then arrived back in England. So, and they weren't accepted until the 1860s, really, in England, or in some cases even a little later. So, and the ice ages were super important for a number of reasons. I mean, the biggest reason was that about 20,000 years ago, which is the time we had the last maximum of the glaciers on the Earth, the glaciers have come and gone a number of times in the last million years, but about 10 times actually, but about 20,000 years ago, we had a big, the glaciers were what we call the last glacial maximum, and sea level was about 400 feet lower. So, and then when the glaciers melted, sea level rose about 400 feet over a few thousand years, and at the same time, the portions of the continents which had been covered by ice and essentially depressed by the weight of the ice rose up, but they rose up more slowly. So the Darwin was, when he was on the Beagle, was imagining that sea level was kind of a constant that he could use as a datum as he looked at the rocks and the uplifted shells that he saw in the cliffs and in the terraces around South America. But in fact, sea level had gone up and down in this rather complicated way. And so it was really 100 years after Darwin that finally got sorted out. And then, of course, the other big development in geology that Darwin was unable to foresee, I mean, he just didn't, just happened, was the ability to understand the absolute age of the Earth. And Darwin realized that early on that the Earth was really old, and but he didn't know how old, and they didn't really have a very good way of measuring it. And after Darwin realized that in order for evolution to occur, there needed to be a long, 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 long time. And so he was convinced that the Earth was old. But he got into some arguments with the physicists active in England at the time. The most important was Lord Kelvin. And Lord Kelvin had calculated the age of the Earth based on the idea it was kind of an iron sphere that was cooling from the time the Earth had started. And he came up with the idea that the Earth was only a million years old or so. He had a couple different estimates, but they were all quite relatively short. Darwin didn't believe it. He thought the Earth was much older. And all the geologists, I think, by that time just couldn't accept Kelvin's ideas. And then what happened was radioactivity was discovered, and that just totally blew Kelvin's ideas about the age of the Earth out of the water, because the heat was constantly being generated by radioactivity, and so it permitted the Earth to be much older. But at the same time, the discovery of radioactivity ultimately allowed us to make absolute measurements of the Earth, and now of the age of the Earth, and now we know the Earth is something like 4.6 billion years old, which gives Darwin plenty of time for evolution to happen and for all the other amazing things to happen, like the movement of the continents and so on.
Rob Wesson is our guest. His career in earthquake research with the U.S. Geological Survey spans over four decades. He's currently a scientist emeritus at the USGS. Again, the name of the new book is Darwin's First Theory, published by Pegasus. So when Darwin returns, as you say, when he returns to England, what is the immediate response and what impact does this have on his next work, of course, which is the theory of evolution?
Well, when Darwin returned to England, he was immediately welcomed by open arms by Charles Lyell and into the Geological Society of London, which was the premier geologic organization at that time. And he gave a number of papers at the Geological Society about his ideas about the uplift of continents and the depression of the ocean basins, and they were welcomed by the kind of wing of the geological community that was behind Lyell. There was a big argument. It was a hard sell that mountains rose gradually because people really just couldn't understand how this could happen. They preferred really to think about some kind of catastrophe that had happened in the past, whether it was religious or whatever. They didn't know why it might have happened, but it seemed easier to imagine that rocks were folded and mountains were uplifted by some catastrophe than by some process that was going on all the time. But so Darwin became initially, he, of course, his collections that he made as well were led to fame, and the fossils that he collected. Because, you know, now looking at it from our perspective, we understand that when the continent of South America was isolated from the other continents from about a few hundred million years ago until just maybe as recently as 10 or even 3 million years ago, that the species that were on the continent developed in isolation. And so there were a number of species that the fossils of which that Darwin collected, especially the ground sloth, the giant ground sloths. These were, you know, we think about ground sloth as being little fuzzy animals that live in trees, but the giant ground sloths were ground animals, and they were as big as, some of them were as big as elephants. And Darwin collected the fossils of these, and they were relatively little known. There was two species of ground sloths that were recognized earlier, but that's a super interesting story. But anyway, so these fossils led to Darwin's fame as well. So his geologic ideas and his collections all led to Darwin's fame. And he was elected to the Royal Society in 1839, and he was well established as he was beginning to come up with these large, somewhat heretical ideas about evolution. And then, of course, he didn't really end up publishing his ideas about evolution until 1859. So it was two decades later before he... And one of the interesting things is Darwin had friends that were... Joseph Hooker, in particular, was a botanist. And Hooker... Darwin kind of was obliquely suggested to Hooker and Lyell and some of his other friends some of his ideas about evolution. But he didn't really come out and say what he was thinking about. And in one of his exchanges with Hooker, Hooker basically was, you know, didn't quite understand the question that Darwin was asking him. But in essence, he said, Hooker said to Darwin, "I wouldn't believe anything that about the origin of a species from someone who doesn't really understand what a species is, who hasn't really studied a species." So this, it's my view, and I think of other people that have looked at it, that this led to Darwin's work on barnacles, which he spent 7 years dissecting barnacles and studying fossil barnacles. He really became the world's expert on both living and fossil barnacles. And so by this time, he was an expert on species, so he checked that obstacle off to developing his credibility. So by the time he came up with and did publish his ideas about the origin of species, he not only was well recognized as a geologist, but also recognized as an expert on in biology, at least in the area of barnacles. So there don't seem to be many people around today who would spend 7 years just to gain additional credibility about it, to boost their credibility to describe a new idea.
How do you think your book and this story fills out our understanding of Darwin and his overall work as a scientist?
Well, I hope it fulfills it. I think, especially in the United States, people haven't understood this aspect of Darwin. They just kind of are focused in on his contributions to biology. But in England, I think maybe they have a little bit better understanding of it. But it seems to me it's really important that Darwin viewed Homo sapiens as one, you know, species that was inhabiting this planet. And, you know, Homo sapiens we're kind of like entitled teenagers. We kind of imagine that the world is here for us and we can pretty much do with it what we want. And that's, from a geologic point of view, that's really, it's not the way things are. It's, we're kind of latecomers on this planet. The planet is formed well before we got here. Lots of things have happened. And if Homo sapiens really wants to understand its place on the planet, and we do need to understand that if we're going to think about global change, about the geologic hazards we face, about what is our ultimate? One hesitates to talk about the extinction of Homo sapiens, but the history of the planet and the species on the planet is that none of these species last forever. And but if we want to do the best we can on the planet, we need to understand our place on the planet. And I hope my book is a tiny contribution to accomplishing that.
The name of the book is Darwin's First Theory, Exploring Darwin's Quest to Find a Theory of the Earth. The book is published by Pegasus. Rob Wesson, thank you very much for spending time with us. A pleasure to have you on the program.
Joe, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Again, the name of the book, Darwin's First Theory by Rob Wesson, published by Pegasus. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.